Whether we're talking about the AI story, the war in Iran, things are very nuanced. This is fraught with dangers. I do think it can be pulled off though, but that's a game changer to me in the equation with China. So I think that's one America first aspect that's not getting a lot of play. There's a game being played with China here when you look at both Venezuela and Iran.
Mel Madison is a writer, investor, and fintech executive with 25 plus years in US financial infrastructure, a former CEO of three broker-dealers.
He brings deep expertise in private equity and macroeconomics. He's the author of Quoz, a financial thriller exploring the future of quantum AI, central banking, and blockchain.
We could see 4 rate cuts this year easily, whereas the market right now is only thinking 2. If you add in the European commitments and a big increase in defense spending from the US, and you add in the CapEx from the hyperscalers, I mean, you're talking about well over $1 trillion of essentially spending into the economy. I think we're at the verge of breaking one way or the other. If we break lower, I gave you the target range around.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today, it's my pleasure to have Mel back on the show. We had him already twice, so it's great to have you back, Mel.
Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy our conversations.
Yes, so do I. Always important to talk to somebody like you who's got quite a good overview on everything that's going on. Obviously, I want to start out talking about the US-Israel versus Iran conflict. It's just only recently erupted. I was just recently in Dubai. You know, that's why my family and like my wife and everyone was sort of shocked to see that there were a couple of bombs dropped down on Dubai. And like my brother was just at a hotel a couple of weeks ago, the Fairmont, the one that was also burning up front. So that was kind of surreal to see. Okay, we were just there a couple of weeks ago, but maybe, yeah, I'd love to hear your perspective. You know, what is going on? What have you been able to gather so far? And how do you interpret what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of those attacks on some of the Gulf countries are some of the more surprising outcomes thus far. And it is only about, you know, 2 days in, and we're recording here on Monday morning. So the markets have just opened up for the first time. And I think when the news was first released, there's probably an expectation of a pretty big drop. And it's been muted so far, but it's very early. And as we're speaking, the markets are coming back, not quite in positive territory, but definitely not down significantly. I think this is a very critical thing, and it kind of plays into some general commentaries and thoughts I've had on President Trump for a long time, is that his own view of himself as a very important historical figure, willing to do things that I think most people did not think, you know, a U.S. president would be willing to do. And I think in his first term, he was much more subdued. I think last year, his major shock to the system was obviously the tariffs and the way those were rolled out. And I think this year, definitely the Maduro raid was shocking. And I think history and time will tell whether or not this was a good decision. I think right now, within the market, whether we're talking about the AI story, the war in Iran, things are very nuanced. They're very uncertain, and they're also very conflicted. And I think even before this, the market has been conflicted. Since October, especially in the US, you know, talking about the US market, we've just been trading in a range. If you look at other places around the world, emerging markets, South Korea, certain sectors like chips and memory and different things, materials, energy, there's been a very strong bull market going on. And so it's been very, as they say, kind of nuanced, uncertain, and really just kind of a complicated picture. And the market's trying to make sense of all this. And I think this just adds a whole nother element of what to try to make sense of. And I find it actually very a sign of the market's strength that the money has been rotating around and not really just flushing out of equities completely. And that's why the S&P is only down 2 or 3% from the highs as we speak. If that can continue for how long, who knows? But I do think we're getting close to a point where it needs to kind of break one way or another. So to give you my broad outlook, I think medium and longer term, I'm bullish on equities in the US, for example. In the short term, I think we can go either way. I think we could have a quick 10% correction with everything that's going on, a big flush out. I don't think it would be as deep as April of last year. I think it would be more something around the 10-12% range from the highs, which would basically kind of take us back to the all-time highs in February of last year before the tariff tantrum was around 615 on the SPYs. And that would be a painful correction to go through for the markets. You know, as we speak, we're not too far away from 7,000 on the S&P. So to get closer down into that six range, but I do think that would probably be healthy and a buying opportunity, even though it would be scary if it happens. On the other hand, with all those negative things we've talked about, you also have these positive cross currents going on. You have a lot of CapEx spending. You have, I believe, a potential for more rate cuts. You have fiscal spending. You have an election year where the administration is going to want to kind of throw out all the stops to get this economy going. You have the potential for even more fiscal stimulus. It could be, obviously, the tariff refund checks aren't going to happen. But you've had with this war really now beginning kind of a necessitation for a lot of the contemplated military spending to actually happen. Trump has talked about wanting to raise the defense budget to $1.5 trillion. Obviously, the European nations have committed to spending more on defense. So, I mean, if you add in the European commitments and a big increase in defense spending from the US and you add in the CapEx from the hyperscalers, I mean, you're talking about well over $1 trillion of essentially spending into the economy. And so if all of that happens, those types of things are normally positive. And so this is where I get into my complex, nuanced, you know, uncertain picture. Recently, the sentiment has been very negative. I think because of this uncertainty, a lot of people have decided to sell, take profits, ask questions later. But I think time's going to tell whether we break out of this range up to the upside or take a brief dip lower. But I feel pretty confident that in the medium to longer term, we are going to go higher. We can get into why. And I'm just kind of positioned for either one of those outcomes by not having a lot of kind of short-term options, things of that nature, and having some protection and then being invested in some of the sectors that I think, regardless of what we do, are going to be doing well. Some of the emerging markets, I think, are going to do well. And so that's kind of my overall read on the economic and financial situation right now.
Imagine lowering your tax bill while stacking Bitcoin. With Blockware, you can. Thanks to new tax guidelines, you can write off 100% of your mining hardware costs in a single year. Blockware's mining as a service takes care of everything, so you can start mining Bitcoin effortlessly. Visit mining.blockwaresolutions.com/LNMS and get $100 off for your first miner.
Yes, lots of great points to unpack there. Maybe I want to get into the entire macro view a little later, but maybe stay with the situation at hand just for now. You know, like you mentioned Trump, and I feel like you're exactly right. He wants to build this statue for himself. It almost feels like, okay, he has this one last run to go, you know, and then he wants to make history in that sense. But then, I mean, how do you interpret now what he's doing to Iran? Like, what's his bigger goal here? Because with the Trump, like the tariffs, you know, a lot of people felt like, okay, it's about balancing trade. He's got these papers that they published way back in 2024. So it sort of kind of makes sense. But now with Iran and also maybe Venezuela, like with these actual conflicts, you know, what is the target here? Is it like so resourcing resources, or is it trying to hurt somebody else economically, or yeah, what's it about?
Yeah, I personally think there's a lot going on. I think there's a game being played with China here. When you look at both Venezuela and Iran, as big providers of the one thing that China really needs but doesn't have, which is oil and energy. I think there is a historical legacy aspect to it. And I think, I'm basically of the age where, I know this whole regime, right? So I remember the first Ayatollah. I remember when this current, the recently deceased Ayatollah came in. And Iran has been constantly throughout my entire life, this kind of thorn in the side of both peace in the Middle East. And they really have been a rogue nation. I mean, whether or not this was a good idea, we can talk about, but I think there's no doubt that Iran is kind of up there with North Korea as one of these states that has really decided, we don't care if we're a pariah of the world system. We want to basically make money with blackmail, with corruption, with terror, and it's very ideological and religiously motivated. I don't doubt and I don't make fun of the faith of these people. I think that there are some people at the top of this theocracy who truly do want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. They truly want to eliminate the United States. And when they say death to America and enrich uranium to 60 or 70%, I think it's a pretty big gamble for the world to just say, well, we don't think they're going to, really create a weapon. And I think what's been the status quo is keep an eye on them, keep them on sanctions, but let's not take that step that Trump has just taken because it's a very risky step, right? And I think what probably brought Trump over to do it is I think perhaps for the first time, he has some backing from other countries in the region beyond just Israel for this. I think Saudi Arabia in particular, but I think a lot of these countries, they're a little bit like, they know they're sitting on a lot of oil that's bringing in a lot of money. And they hate the fact that kind of Israel is there in one sense, but they're willing to tolerate that and work in the system and have their private jets and their yachts and provide for their citizens. And they know this oil isn't going to last forever. And they want to take advantage of it while they have it. And Iran just keeps being this kind of thorn, in the side. There's also the internal religious differences, the Shia Sunni aspects to this. And so I think that even if you look at the European nations, I mean, not one of them has said, well, we think Iran as a sovereign country has a right to have a nuclear weapon. I think most people understand, like I said, it's just kind of too big of a gamble in such a economically sensitive area of the world, the Middle East, because of oil, to allow a large nation with over 90 million people to have nuclear weapons and the type of havoc that that creates. Saudi Arabia has said, if Iran gets a weapon, we're going to need to get a weapon. You're going to, you start an arm. I mean, the type of things that would spiral. And I think the pushback is, well, they haven't gotten a nuclear weapon yet. And I think to some extent they have used it as blackmail, and they've played this line of, we're going to get close, but we're not going to do it. That way they won't do what just happened. But in the meantime, it gives us kind of leverage and we can play these games and so on. And I think in some sense, it reminds me a little bit of a situation of, let's say like you're like a guy like The Rock. If you constantly go to this bar, right? Like, year after year, you regularly go to this place. And there's this kind of smaller guy there who's always kind of trying to cause you trouble, heckle you, start a fight. And you're always kind of like, this guy's a jerk. He's a pain in my butt, but he's not worth my time. And you never know what can happen. The guy could have some hidden brass knuckles, a 9mm, some friends waiting to jump in. Obviously, probably I could kick his butt in 2 seconds, but you know what? It's not worth it. I'm just going to deal with it. He wants to heckle me and I'll go on with my evening. And like after years and years and years of it, it's like one day The Rock comes in and says, you know what? I had enough. And we're going to see what happens. We're going to see if it does work out or not. And I think there's a good chance it does work out. I also think there's a whole other element here with Israel that a lot of people are upset about. The fact that it's a little more nuanced to see the American benefits to this. I think they have to do with controlling more oil in China and playing that game. And I also think they have to do with Trump's vision of peace in the Middle East and being a historical figure. But I think there's also legitimate criticism that a lot of people make, that the powerful Israeli lobby, Benjamin Netanyahu, a lot of the big billionaire backers of Trump in the United States have kind of pushed him into this. And I think there might be some of that going on. And so like I said, it's nuanced, it's complex. It's not like, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's about time we did it. Let's go. There's not going to be any problems. This is totally America first. No, not at all. Mm. This is fraught with dangers. I do think it can be pulled off, though, but we will see.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point that you just raised, you know, because the America first, you know, that's something in Europe all the people still have in front of their eyes when they think about Trump. And now I guess a lot of people are like, okay, even legitimately, like, okay, how does this help the average American? You know, like him being this rock bully who now kind of says enough is enough, you know, and he really wants to go after these villains, which rightly so is maybe the right thing to do, playing this geopolitical chess. And as you said, he might be successful after all, and the world in and of itself will be a better place. Let's hope. But then, there are midterms coming up, you know, people are like, why isn't Trump more focused on his own people? Shouldn't that be his primary goal? And so you have any thoughts on this? Because that's an argument that I've been hearing people make, you know?
Well, I think maybe we could get into this later too, with the macro finance side of kind of like an anti-Centrini, like uber positive possible scenario for markets, which I think is, you know, there's tail risks on both sides of this market, also to the downside, but also to the upside over the next couple of years. But I think if I was going to say like the overall strategy for the golden age for the containment policy of China is the U.S. has constantly spent a lot of time and effort in the Middle East. The U.S. strategically would like to pivot more to Asia and China containment, as well as shore things up in the Western Hemisphere. As I mentioned earlier, two of the major sources of oil for China at a discounted price have been Venezuela and Iran. And so if the United States has a little bit more sway over those parties, this is actually a little reminiscent of World War II, where the United States controlled essentially the oil that Japan needed. And even though the United States was not yet at war with Japan, they essentially shut off the spigot because they had some level of control. And most historians will argue that this was one of the primary reasons, if not the main and almost only reason, Japan didn't want to start a war with the United States, but they were being denied oil by the United States in the Pacific. And they felt the need to take over the Pacific in order to get the oil from that region that was available there that the U.S. was denying them. And so if you give the United States essentially more control over that oil, that is a big card in Trump's parlance. Who has the cards? That would be an ace in the hole, so to speak, that the U.S. now gets from a geostrategic standpoint. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about this. It's one of the first things that came to my head when I saw this Venezuela next Iran thing. And the one connection between them is this oil to China connection. I think that that's maybe on purpose not being talked that much about in the mainstream media because it's antagonistic to China. And we want people to somewhat think this is just about like Trump being in the back pocket of Israel. And so that's a much more easy narrative for China maybe to stomach than this is about the U.S. as the world's largest oil producer, exerting more control in the largest oil producing region of the world, as well as the largest oil producer, not oil producer, but the largest known oil reserves in the world in Venezuela. Imagine that. The U.S. has some level of control over the largest reserves in Venezuela, the largest producer in the United States, and has partners in Saudi Arabia and maybe a more friendly regime in Iran. That's a game changer to me in the equation with China. So I think that's one America first aspect that's not getting a lot of play. I think secondarily is the Middle East. If Iran is gone with the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, who is more progressive and a newer generation, willing to accept and perhaps recognize Israel, that there's this potential for the Middle East to produce more oil more cheaply. Trump has always wanted low oil. He's a drill baby. He believes, and I think rightly so, that oil is very largely tied to inflation. If oil prices can get low and stay low, it opens up the window for more rate cuts, which can help housing, which can help stimulate the economy. And so I think the big disaster would be this turns into a longer war, creates a long-term spike in oil, creates inflation. I mean, that's what I've talked about in the beginning. This is very fraught with risk. This is a high risk, high reward play. If it works out, and in 3 or 4 months, we've got crude kind of stuck in the 50s or 60s for as far as the eye can see, and the U.S. doesn't have to maybe spend as much attention and military assets in the Middle East on an ongoing basis, and has this greater grip of control on oil, then you're talking about, you know, like I said, a game changer vis-a-vis China. So I think those are the American first aspects, but I also don't deny that there are very large, powerful political donors in the United States that have essentially a dual allegiance between Israel and the United States. Some of them might be U.S. citizens, but they might even have a more deep allegiance to Israel. And so those elements are there. I think they can be acknowledged, but I don't think it's fair to say that there's no conceivable reason from an America First perspective for this to take place.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, that's well argued. I mean, I just remember this chart that I saw a couple of days ago where people were showing that the U.S., like this shift away from importing crude oil, you know, from Saudis and then also other Kuwait, Bahrain, all these sort of Gulf states. I mean, it's been going down only ever since. Like the U.S. has really diversified. They got their own, I guess, by now. And they are really sort of prepared for this as well. It's not that it's just shooting out of the hip, you know. And so I think it might not hurt the U.S. after all that much. And it might hurt Europe and China, as you said, you know, who are maybe not as well prepared for something like this to really escalate. So these are some great points. But maybe my last question on this is, you know, what to watch now? Like you said, if this were to really spiral into a longer term or prolonged conflict, then things might be sort of worse. I know a lot of people say you always just want to fade geopolitical risk. You know, it's always been the right play. But like, what are you looking at? You know, is it this Strait of Hormuz that there people are talking about? If this gets shut down, or like more oil infrastructure is getting sort of damaged, or the OPEC countries, if they maybe not increase production, if we get some sort of supply shock, what is it that you're looking at to kind of assess the situation?
I will answer that. Just one last thing to add on that last point too, about the U.S. currently being the largest producer. A lot of this is from the fracking. It's from, you know, we have a lot of these refineries that were set up to kind of mine like heavier crude. And a lot of the easy fracking, except for maybe areas in the Permian Basin, they're kind of getting a little depleted. And so I think that's one of the looks at the Venezuela thing is, while right now the U.S. is kind of in the catbird seat as a massive producer, it doesn't seem like there's much for us to expand. And so that ties into the Venezuela thing. Again, I never bought that the Venezuela thing was about narco trafficking, right? To get into, I'm sorry, possible downsides, the risks, and where, well, I think that this could go really wrong. I think, you know, the United States does not have a lot of ammunition, you know, a lot of ordnance. We have given or sold a lot to Ukraine. We don't have a mobilized, beefed up industrial capacity. We can make a very limited number of things like Patriot missiles or the THAAD anti-missile systems yearly. And those will obviously get ramped up. The defense stocks are obviously soaring today. But, you know, I think that's one of the reasons, if you actually think about the name, Epic Fury, it is the fury part of it is this recognition. This needs to be like a quick UFC knockout fight. This can't be a 13 round, you know, Rocky Balboa, Apollo Creed, Rocky One, you know, battle to the final bell, because honestly, Iran can go, people can go into caves, they can go underground areas, they have a population that is divided. A lot of a number of the population has their economic ties to the regime. You know, I think like 20% or something like that are somehow connected. They have like a million man army. So there's a lot of people that on both sides, and there's only one side that has guns. You know, it's not like the United States where every house has like three guns in it. So, you know, the million troops that they have there, the Iranian Republican Guard Corps and the Iranian Republican Militia are a sizable force. And so, and they have shown that they're not afraid to kill thousands of their own citizens as they did last month. So if this gets out of hand into a civil war and it gets drawn out in 4 or 5 weeks from now, I kind of think it needs to end sooner than that, to be honest with you. I kind of think this needs to somehow wrap itself up in the next 1 to 2 weeks, because I do think that the U.S. political desire for it will fade very quickly. I think that our ammunitions will fade and defense things will fade very quickly. There's a good argument to be made that the 12-day war last year was ended because basically the U.S. and Israel were running out of ways to shoot down Iranian missiles, and they needed to tie a bow on that thing because otherwise Tel Aviv and places like in U.S. bases were going to be sitting ducks. So I think this needs to be a furious type pace. And I think that's what they're attempting to do here. I do think, like I said, I'm not, you know, saying anything negative about people's religious beliefs. I do think there's a number of people that believe over there in martyrdom. They have a culture of it, the virgins, all of that. And so it's a different type of a calculus than a group of people in Venezuela who maybe hated Maduro, were promised a bunch of stuff from the U.S., and said, you know, adios, you know, to Maduro, you know, we never liked you anyways. We'll play a little ball with the U.S. here, line our pockets, and on we go. I think this is a different animal entirely. And so you don't want to project your own kind of Western values onto a culture that sees things differently and think that if we just inflict a bunch of pain, then you know, they'll give in 2 weeks. And so if that doesn't happen, and then you mentioned the Strait of Hormuz, 20% of the world's oil goes through there. It's not just Iranian oil. And, you know, we destroyed a lot of their Navy ships yesterday. We have minesweepers, I'm sure, in the region and different things. But, you know, if these ships are not going to be able to get insurance to go through there and different things, on the other hand, you also have an Iranian backer in China who, again, does not want to see the Straits of Hormuz closed for a long time. And so you have these competing, you know, elements of why I personally think if traffic is cut off, it won't be cut off for too long, days, a week, 2 weeks, but at some point something will be done to do it. Now, if that's unsuccessful, Iran is somehow able to shut down the strait for a month. And like I said, we get this prolonged oil shock. There will be significant economic damage. There will be inflationary pressures. There will be stock market turmoil. There will be basically a disaster waiting for Trump and team in the midterms. So I'm confident they're going to do everything they can that doesn't happen. That doesn't mean it's not a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you have these people now coming out of their hiding, you know, calling for oil to creep up to $100 a barrel. You know, they're already seeing this happen. But I feel like, as you just said, I mean, things would have to escalate quite quickly and for a prolonged time. And I guess nobody is sort of interested in this. I mean, there is this meme, you know, nothing ever happens. And so we'll see. At some point, maybe things spiral out of control, but maybe it's for another day. And let's not hope it will happen. And yeah, I mean, inflation is sort of a key word. You know, what's the general view on inflation then? Like, notwithstanding that there might be an oil shock or whatever. So, like, where do you see this going? Because, like, I think we just also had ISM up in January, and we got just the latest numbers. I guess it was also still above 50. Came in 5.2, I guess, you know, just 0.2% lower than in January. And a lot of people were saying, well, in January, you know, this increase reflected post-holiday restocking, front-loading, preemptive buying ahead of more expected tariffs. But now we get another ISM that is sort of above this magic line of 50, and things seem to be reaccelerating. And so, yeah, what's your view on inflation?
I do think the economy is reaccelerating. And I think that we do tend to see higher inflation prints in the beginning of the year. They try to seasonally adjust these things, but you tend to get the higher prints that wind up being usually above expectations in the first quarter. They start to ease out in the second and third quarters, and it simmers down, and you start to get the below expectation prints, probably just in time for when Kevin Warsh takes over, which I think is like 96% likelihood. I think there's, with Trump, you never know. You know, I mean, it could always be a last minute change of mind or something happens. But I do think that inflation is also, you know, heading down. I think that there are these massive kind of structural deflationary forces in the economy, not the least of which is AI, productivity increases. And I think that low oil prices, I'm a big believer that oil is, if you overlay an oil chart with CPI, it's amazing how correlated they are. And, you know, let's remember that like people are flipping out about oil, like spiking to $72 a barrel or whatever it did today. You know, I think Brent touched 80 or something like that. Those are still relatively low numbers. I mean, you go back to 2007 when crude was almost like $150 a barrel, and then you adjust that for inflation, that's well over $200 a barrel. I mean, we're like a third of the inflation adjusted high price in crude right now, even with all of this going on. And so I think a lot of people didn't understand also how much I think the pandemic really along with electrification has really lowered the demand for crude, because there are a lot of people in Western countries that work remotely and don't drive as much, and maybe go into the office 2 or 3 days a week instead of 5 or different things. And then you have the electric cars, which are not huge, but that makes a dent. You have, even with the gasoline powered vehicles, are a lot more efficient than they used to be. There's a lot of hybrids on the road. And I think if energy can stay low, then I think inflation will be under control and nothing to worry about, and will open the door for more rate cuts, which will probably be needed. I think, you know, we haven't really gotten into AI yet, but I think that has profound implications for monetary policy going forward and how loose central banks can be, which is much looser than what I think the market expects. And so I think there's a lot on the line with this Iran thing, and that inflation, because of these deflationary forces, because of the subdued oil prices and energy prices, natural gas is subdued as well. There's potential for us to get below 2% by the end of the year on PCE, the Fed's target. And if it is, and we're seeing weak hiring environments because of AI, and the Federal Reserve has a full employment mandate, unlike the ECB, only focused on inflation, and you've got a guy like Warsh who thinks as long as you're not printing money, you can keep rates pretty low. And, you know, we could see 4 rate cuts this year easily, whereas the market right now is only thinking 2.
Yeah, that's actually one of the questions I'm asking myself as well. I mean, the market is currently just pricing 50 basis cut points of cuts, you know, and you're thinking it might be somewhere higher. I mean, yeah, there was also this chart that I saw people share, you know, that like if you compare these short-term futures, 2017 to 2016, I guess they've been falling off a cliff, you know, also kind of telling us that the market is expecting that that the rates will just be lower in 2027 as well. I mean, you spoke of AI, you know, and that's maybe a topic I want to turn to, you know, this uncertainty. I guess nobody really knows where it's going, you know, because we had this Citrini article, you probably saw it as well, you know, that where he laid out this sort of future scenario. But I feel like you have like these two options, you know. On the one hand, there's a deflationary boom, you know, that raises living standards faster than any prior technology before. That's maybe something that's in the cart. But then on the other hand, you have this sort of structural disruption coming to the labor income consumption loop, you know. As you said, you know, just disrupting just the way we work and stuff. And so the whole sort of economy would be kind of disrupted, you know, because if that gets sort of disrupted as well. So, yeah, I don't know.
What is your thoughts there? How do we, because it's sort of also conflicting in some sense, at least in my mind.
It's very conflicting. And I mean, in the Citrini piece in the beginning, he says, look, this is just a plausible situation. It's not even necessarily my base case. It's just kind of a musing of what could potentially happen in a few years. And I think there is, you know, potential for some of those types of things to occur, and they probably would be relatively disastrous for equity prices and markets and the economy. I also think there's a plausible ultra uber bullish situation that I don't think is my base case, but like I could write a contra Citrini note if I wanted to. Like, here's my 2028 macro newsletter, and it's like, you know, S&P's hitting 10,000 because of X, Y, and Z. We could get into what that would mean. And I think at the end of the day, nobody really knows. And so this is where I go back to my original thing. Nuanced and uncertainty are two key theme points. And I think the uncertainty is really, you know, it's killing markets. It's like people say, you know, it's like a lot of the value, equities are long duration assets. A lot of the value is the terminal value. What's going to happen? Do I think like software is a good thing to buy? No, I've never thought software is a good thing to buy really in a long time. I've always been more focused on gold, Bitcoin, emerging markets, physical world, materials, gold miners. You know, these have been my bread and butter ways to play the rebound. I always would tell people, hey, yeah, the S&P was great, was pretty good last year, but you know, Brazil was up 50%. And you know, you know, a day like today, you know, emerging markets came in. That was one of the few things I bought at the open this morning because I think the dollar, you know, spiked at the open quite a bit. And, you know, I'm going to wait and see what happens. Right now, as we're talking at, you know, 11 o'clock on Monday, we've got the S&P back up almost to positive territory, you know, which I think a lot of people thought was crazy. I posted a tweet on Saturday right after the news broke. Like, I'm not going to be surprised if we hit over 700 in the S&Ps by the end of the week. And this thing has a little bit of a bow on it. And I think a lot of people would think that's absolutely nuts. I'm not saying that's, again, my base case. But what I am saying is there's those two aspects I go to in the beginning, where when you have this long consolidation, the S&P and Q's kind of trading in this balance range for months, it needs to relieve that tension at some point. And when it does, it usually does so in a big way. It could be a quick breakdown all the way to that, you know, February 2025 high of like 615, 620 on the SPYs. It could also be a nice breakup to something like the 725, 730 range on SPYs by the end of next month. And so we've got this dichotomy, this bifurcation going on right now because of how things could play out. With the Trump administration, you just don't know. This could turn into a protracted, ridiculous mess. And we could be at 620 on the SPYs in 2 weeks. Or on Wednesday, he could announce that talks are restarting in Geneva. I found someone I think would be a good fit to run Iran. And we're closing out the week at record highs. I mean, that is the type of uncertainty that you're seeing, which is kind of infuriating to a lot of investors and frustrating because there's not this consistent trend. But it does provide some opportunities.
But uncertainty, again, is a great keyword, you know, that I want to double check or to double click on. I mean, because, you know, Bitcoin, it's been not doing well ever since October 10th, you know, where we had this huge deleveraging event. And obviously, I'm focused on Bitcoin as well. And now a lot of people have been pointing to this correlation to software, you know, that you just mentioned. And software certainly hasn't been the talk of the town, or at least not among investors who want to make money. But then now, why is Bitcoin lagging? Is it because of this correlation? Is it lumped into the same bucket? Or is it because of the huge uncertainty that we have right now? Or is it just other things are playing right now? It's the global industrials, it's defense stocks, it's all these sort of other things that are withdrawing liquidity from Bitcoin. And so, yeah, how do you interpret this?
Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is something that I've gotten wrong in recent months. And so I've dialed back like the risk I have in it. I still have my large core position in it, and I still believe that it is going higher, and I still believe there is potential for it to outperform gold this year, as was one of my beginning of the year predictions. It's still, you know, March 2nd as we're talking, so there's a long, long time left in this year. I think gold's going to have a spectacular year. That's my largest position, always is gold and gold-related stocks. And, you know, but Bitcoin, I think a number of things are going on. And I think for a long time, the tight correlation between Bitcoin and software was a little bit masked because there was such a tight correlation between the NASDAQ and software that everybody just said Bitcoin is a risk on asset. That's what it's correlated to. And what we've seen is this separation where software is going into like a bear market, NASDAQ's kind of trading in this range, not really too far away from highs. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin has been tracking the IGV. You know, you lay over an IGV, the software ETF, to Bitcoin. And I think that we could be at the beginning of a decorrelation from that. And that is a huge thing. And just last night when futures opened and equities futures were down significantly, Bitcoin was up along with gold. And so if people are beginning to realize, as I think they will, that you need to get this decoupling, and it's not going to be a quick and easy process. On the one hand, Bitcoin being up could have been an early tell that there really wasn't a lot of huge selling pressure today. As we're speaking, like I said, the S&P is kind of flat, which is probably shocking to a lot of people after this weekend. But that's early separation is people recognizing that if they're uncertain about equities, particularly tech in the United States, the largest sector, you add tech and communication services, it's just massive weighting. In the U.S., which has become a massive weighting of global equities, that money needs to come out of there and go other places. Those other places are where I want to have my money. Those other places are things like emerging markets, international materials, physical world, as Jordy Visser likes to talk about, scarcity, not abundance. And then I think Bitcoin needs to become something like that, because the thing with these software names is like, okay, you want to have some sort of a reasonable valuation based on a terminal value and say, you know, what's going to happen? If you don't know that, where are you going to put the money? As some of these other asset classes get kind of, the gas tanks are getting filled on them. So, you know, Brazil was at like 7 or 8 times the earnings last year. Now it's, you know, closer in the teens. You know, as some of the valuations go up in some of these other assets that have been under-owned for years, and those gas tanks get full, you've got two main gas tanks that I think you got two main gas tanks out there that are not tied to like valuations or cash flows, right? You've got gold and you've got Bitcoin. And so it's a place for excess money. And this will tie into the longer term strategic view that if we are going to need to essentially flood the system with liquidity because of deflationary AI pressures, and this money needs to go somewhere, and people don't want it to put it in the housing, it's already full of values. They don't want to put it into the S&P, it's full of values. They don't want to put it into, you know, we're filling up the tank on the international and the emerging markets, and the chip stocks are starting to get a little crazy. And it's like, okay, now where? You know, and where can you go where there's like a financial justification? Or perhaps more properly said, where can you go where there's not a financial de-justification, if that's even a word, where like, you know, if gold isn't based on cash flows, if Bitcoin's not based on cash flows, you can't argue, oh, the valuation's too high, you know? Yeah, and that's why I think gold can go to $20,000 an ounce, and Bitcoin can go to $200,000 an ounce in the next couple of years, or 200,000 a coin in the next couple of years. These things are all very possible because these stores of values, essentially, they reorientate the world's economic system towards a more neutral reserve asset. I think that is going to be gold. I don't think those central banks are going to start piling into Bitcoin. But I do think that there is a space for Bitcoin. And at a $2 trillion, less than $2 trillion market cap right now, it doesn't take a whole ton of that software money to come into Bitcoin to really make the price. And then if we can get some clarity, so no pun intended, but the Clarity Act passed, but get some clear regulation, then if we start to see some real use cases of the whole blockchain technology through AI agents and greater adoption of stable coins, and people start saying, hey, this crypto is a real deal and Bitcoin is kind of the big daddy, you know, gold standard of crypto, I want to have a piece of that, you can start to rebuild the bullish narrative. And price always leads the narrative. So we need to start seeing it in price. And maybe we're starting to see that, you know, maybe Bitcoin is bottom. On some of my chart work, it definitely looks like where we hit, it makes a lot of sense for a bottom, and we can start going higher. And I think if we get Bitcoin stabilizing, software stabilizing, maybe even rebounding a little bit, because there are some babies that were thrown out with the bathwater there. I mean, I don't think like people are going to start using OpenClaw to do enterprise cybersecurity. You know, I mean, like, I mean, I think the whole way this thing is going to play out is very, it's very nuanced. It's not like, even if you're talking about, I do think margins will get hurt. You know, I think the whole per seat pricing and the premium and the, and really when you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, these software companies have these ridiculous margins and those are going to get compressed. And when you're dealing with one of the largest sectors in the US market, that's why I don't have like a 9,000 target on the S&P or NASDAQ this year, because, you know, I think these are going to kind of tread water. They'll have bounces, you know, but I don't know that they're necessarily as a group going to go significantly lower in the medium short term. And I think that the market can have a way of kind of grinding higher, even with an important sector not going crazy. And the example I'd give of that would be prior to the great financial crisis, financials were the largest sector in the S&P and they were extremely important. We bottomed, and there are names like Citigroup that aren't even half of what they were valued at pre-GFC. There are names like Bank of America that are just now, you know, I think last year made a new post-GFC high. So the largest sector basically did nothing and is still basically negative in some respects, because the XLF, if you look at the sector, includes things like Visa, MasterCard, you look at these big banks, I mean, basically nothing for 15 years in a lot of these things, really. And still the markets climb significantly. So I don't think it's impossible to have the major indexes, particularly the S&P, less so the NASDAQ, but particularly S&P, have a good year and continue to go higher, even if we don't see, you know, Monday.com going to new highs, which I doubt it ever will.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison for sure. I've never heard this, but it makes a lot of sense to me. You mentioned the CapEx spend, you know, that's something that I was thinking of, you know, because I heard this theory tied to AI, you know, it's kind of far-fetched or kind of wonky, but I just want to put it out there. Some people were saying, you know, we're seeing sort of the rotation happening in labor markets right now from information to construction, mostly also because probably software has been lagging and stuff. And on the other side, you know, all these AI data centers need to be built. And that's why sort of we see this expansionary momentum going on in the economy. But then some people were saying, what if like at some point these humanoids come, you know, back to Jordy Fisser, he's saying they're coming maybe at the end of this year. And then, you know, they will start taking over and do the work for us, you know? And so you could have these cyclical indicators all point higher, accelerate into a recession. Sort of that's sort of the thing that I heard. So I don't know, maybe this is a far-fetched argument, but how do you think about stuff like this? Because yeah, as I said, we don't know how also disruptive AI will be, but once they get connected to physical stuff, I feel like, yeah, that's going to be big.
Well, I mean, I do think that that's an important thing to consider. And like I said, it's one of the reasons why, you know, I have very little, you know, kind of allocation to US and to US tech in particular is it. So I do think like, you know, there's this democratization of entrepreneurship, of code, the moats break down. And, you know, a number of these large enterprises are going to go out of business. I mean, their shares are going to go to zero. And it just depends how quickly and how many of them, right? I mean, if this is something that happens over the course of the rest of the decade, and at the same time, you've got other things going on. This is kind of my uber bullish case, which is that it doesn't happen so fast that it catches society too off guard, that we're starting to think about it. Policymakers will start to think about it. We'll start to see it in some of the data where unemployment rates are creeping up, hiring rates are not where they should be, which we're already seeing. And people say, we need to try to get ahead of this. We don't want to ruin the consumer. Maybe there is, over the course of the next decade, a change in the way that Americans and Western economies work. Maybe the five-day work week is a thing of the past. Maybe the recognition of the deflationary aspects of AI opens the door, not necessarily for UBI, but for more fiscal spending, without the inflationary ramifications that then flood the system with liquidity. And so you get a nominal gain in stocks, but you get an even greater gain in things like gold and Bitcoin. And so this has kind of been a long theme that I've been talking about for really as long as I've been kind of talking publicly, is that I believe ultimately that there's very little restriction on money printing in a deflationary environment, that they're essentially keep nominal values rising. Now the key is you don't want to have nominal values rising and wages not keeping up. That was what we had post-pandemic. Part of that in the United States was, you know, a flood of immigration, which is being addressed. And I think people on both sides of the aisle do not want a completely open border in the United States where millions of people just walk in with no idea who they are or where they're coming from and drain social services, et cetera. I think the United States has always been built on immigration, continue to have immigration. But I think that the amount of people that came in kind of really hurt the working class because it really put downward pressure on wages at a time when they should have been going up because of the inflation in the system. So if we get into this rosy anti-Citrini 2028-2029 version of a deflationary environment that creates a potential for uber looseness across the board with major central banks, a reduction in the work week and work time so that the layoffs are not as extreme as I think in Citrini it was like over 10%. Maybe it's 6 or 7%, but maybe there's the money there to really provide the social services and that other people that do still have their jobs are working less, spending more time at restaurants or on vacations or, you know, that there is an upside to productivity. And so if this could be managed, again, this is the uber optimistic one. This is not my plausible base case what's happening. You know, Iran thing's going to work out. Oil is going to stay low. We're going to be inflation. AI is going to happen at a pace that gets manageable. Other sectors of the markets are going to do really well, and they're going to be able to overcome a weakness in certain software names and nominal terms. The markets are going to continue to significantly rise so that the 401ks of the United States don't crash, which essentially the entire pension system is based upon in this country, which is a lot of political rationale for why that's what leaders are going to want. You know, if all of this happens, you then get into this very rosy situation. Probably where we wind up is going to be something in between what I just laid out and what was in that piece. And so I think that it's just, again, you know, the uncertainty, the nuance that is the conflict right now is these competing forces. And then we just threw some, you know, geopolitical icing on top of the cake this weekend. And so to me, it's actually shocking that S&P 500 is down 0.45% as we speak, you know, 30 handles, that's it on this news, and not willing to break the downward rage yet. That doesn't mean that a news piece comes out in 15 minutes that Iran struck an oil tanker and there's a massive spill in the Strait of Hormuz, and you know we're going to be down 2%, and before you can make a trade, the algos are going to. You know, so this is a dangerous time. That's why I said in the very beginning, I have almost no kind of, I have very little like ultra short term risk. I have some kind of tail risk, you know, upside tail risk things put on like April 725 spy calls, but they're not like a large huge position. Most of the actual capital I'm managing right now is more in these things that really should not be too affected by this, like, you know, Brazil, you know, different, you know, Alibaba, which has been sold off a lot lately. And they have, you know, arguably one of the best, you know, open source models in Quen. There's different things out there that I like, but even that is still dialed down a lot. I still have a good amount of cash. I still have the large gold position. I have the core Bitcoin position. I have these physical world US assets. And then I have, you know, some protection for extreme downside moves and some protection also on the upside. So I, you know, the SPY position I have is just calls and puts both, you know, because I think we're at the verge of breaking one way or the other. If we break lower, I gave you the target range around 615, 620, 10 and 11% pullback from the highs, February 2025 highs. And then I think we're going to bounce from there. Everything will be flushed out. But if we break higher, then, you know, like I said, I could see 730 by the end of next month. So those are kind of where I'm sitting.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, I would have two questions left, you know, and then I think we call it the quits. But I mean, in terms of practical advice, you know, I'm a money manager myself. I have a lot of friends hitting me up and, like, you know, who have nothing to do with finance. And they've been told, you know, just put your money into one or two ETFs and you'll be fine, you know, because you have other things to do. You're a painter, you're a dentist, you're whatever. And so over the course of the last couple of years, a lot of people have been putting their money into the S&P 500. You know, that's where they thought, okay, the US, it's the biggest force. We have all these software companies, these tech giants. But now, ever since like maybe the last 12, 18 months, I feel like this, yeah, sort of has shifted. And my sort of easy question or simple question would be, is that still an advice we can give to normal people that they should be allocated to the S&P 500? Or are you like, no, you need to diversify out of this? And if so, yeah, what is it that you would recommend to like simple people who have been holding the S&P 500 so far?
Yeah, I think that's what I give too when like kind of people, I don't maybe have time for a whole deep conversation. And one of the main things I tell them to do is that I tell them they're probably overexposed to U.S. equities. That, you know, in 2010, if you looked at like a chart of trailing 10-year returns, I mean, emerging markets just killed everybody. It had amazing return and low vol relative to that return. And also U.S. equities as a percentage of global equities were more in, I believe, around the 40% range, let's call it, in 2010. I think at the beginning of last year, there was more in the 70 to 80% range. People got way, 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 way over allocated to U.S. equities, particularly tech, particularly the mega caps. And that's why I think you can explain these price movements without necessarily painting the doomsday scenario. That while I do think margins compress different things, that so what I think you want to do is actually be underweight U.S. equities relative. And like I was advising someone European who was living in Dubai, you know, last year I said, I think the largest equity slug should be a, you know, MSCI all world ex-US euro hedged, and I think also advocating larger slices of particular emerging markets. Number one was Brazil, Mexico. Wish I would have had South Korea in there, but and not to have those currency hedged because they're, you know, there are UCITS in Europe that are, you know, MSCI all world ex-US, you know, euro hedged, and that, you know, that was a great way to play it. And I think that dispersion is going to happen, and that all of these valuations are eventually going to get kind of full up, and probably that happens, you know, throughout this year. But as we're there, then some of these other assets like gold and Bitcoin, I think, will be beneficiaries.
But then, just my follow-up question, you think it's not too late to kind of diversify out of this, you know, to say, okay, now, because it's been going on for a couple of months now already, you know, and you say, no, it's still that your cards to play is like try to minimize U.S. exposure in that sense.
Yeah, I think some of these currency, large country equity trends tend to play out over years, sometimes decade or longer. I think when you look at something like a Brazil, like it peaked kind of relative to the S&P like in 2008, you know, almost 20 years, and now it's finally starting to get some outperformance. So I think these are long-term trends that probably we're heading back to a point where the U.S. is 40 or 50% of global equities, and we're not even anywhere near that yet, market cap. And so I don't think it's too early. I don't think that, you know, because some of these have done so well recently, like in the short term, like because the NASDAQ and some of these, like they could have a pop and people could say, oh, the momentum could say, oh, I'm taking some money out of my, you know, SK Hynix and I'm going to put it into Meta because, you know, we're getting it. Like very short term, we could see, you know, kind of a counter cyclical rotation type move there. But I think for like longer term investment horizons, it's definitely not too late. And trying to time it is probably not the best idea to try to say, well, you know what, I'm going to wait for, you know, US to to balance, and then I'll sell it, and then I'll get in. I would start moving, making that allocation change, you know, immediately. Maybe not all of it at once to whatever the dial you want to set it to, but start, you know, making sure if you're like 70-80% of equity exposure is US based and most of that is software, to start dialing that down, even though, yeah, the ideal time to do it would have been last year. But I think waiting and trying to time it perfectly, if you have a long-term horizon, yeah, you might wind up being wrong for the first month or two that you do it if you start doing it now. But it's a difficult game to time when you're doing long-term investing as opposed to like ultra short-term trading. I do some of that, but most of my money is more medium, longer term. And frankly, I'm not that great of an ultra short-term trader. I most of my medium long-term theses tend to do very well. Most of my short-term tend to get screwed up. I probably should just dial that back. But, you know, that luckily, you know, like the vast, vast majority of the capital I have is in medium long-term thesis plays. And it's more kind of almost gambling with a lot of these short-term bets.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably also the way to go. But yeah, last question, and I know it's a big one, but I have to ask it anyways, because I remember in one of our earlier episodes, we established that Trump is sort of this MMT guy. You know, he's maybe he doesn't call himself an MMT guy, but like judging by his actions, he really is fiscal Trump checks, you know, that he wants to do. He was also talking about abolishing the debt ceiling and stuff like this. But now I was increasingly wondering, is this still valid, you know? And my sort of argument is, if you listen to Scott Bessent, if you listen to Kevin Warsh, you know, that you mentioned as well, when these guys are all about shrinking the public balance sheet and they want to kind of privatize the economy, you know, and Kevin Warsh also publicly said, the Fed's balance sheet is too big. He wants to shrink it. You know, he thinks economic growth should come from the private sector. And so like pulling it, these tariffs that they have been pulling in as well, I mean, that's been stabilizing the deficit somewhat, you know, and pulling money out of the private economy. And so is it still true that we can count on Trump just being this sort of fiscal duff, you know, where he would just go and fiscal flows and stimulus just keep it going? Or have we been wrong sort of in that sense, you know?
My inclination was, you know, make some deal with Iran and don't get involved in a war. You know, we'll see how it works out. My other inclination was, of the final four Fed picks, the last one you want to pick is Kevin Warsh. So, you know, I mean, there's also this weird Rothschild connection with him and the Estee Lauder connection, where, you know, his wife's father is like the sole heir to the Estee Lauder fortune and is like the president of the World Jewish Congress, and the chairman is like David the Rothschild, and it's just getting Rothschilds involved in the Federal Reserve, even if it's like ancillary. You just make the case that it's Trump's making it easy for people to make the case he's just an Israeli agent basically at this point, you know, putting in Warsh and going into Iran. I don't think it's that simple, as I spelled out in the beginning of the episode, but I think he's making it an easy case. And the problem with Warsh is I think that he thinks that this fiscal monetary printing is not going to be necessary. And I think he thinks that as the Federal Reserve has enabled large deficit spending, and that it's the Federal Reserve's job to rein that in by not always giving in to and I think ultimately he probably, and it might need to happen through crisis, but we'll have to shift from that view. And he did say openly he supported QE in the beginning of the COVID pandemic. He supported it, I think, during the GFC kind of situation, but that he thought it went on too long and too much. And as you said, that the Fed balance sheet is too big and it needs to be dialed down, and that this is the real driver of inflation. And so I think that ultimately, though, it is a difference between being a governor or being in the private sector and saying these things and being the head of the Federal Reserve when you get these situations. I mean, we see it all the time. I mean, look at Trump, no foreign wars, people get into these positions and the realities of the position sometimes impose themselves on the individual.
Yeah, exactly.
The individual does not have as much freedom of action as that individual thinks. because of outside external pressures. And so I think that the economy will get to a point, especially if this AI deflationary situation plays out, where it is going to need an expanded balance sheet. And that maybe the best guy to do that would be a Kevin Warsh, because people will give him some credit. Like, he's only doing it because he feels it has to be done. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it was a Kevin Hassett doing it, people would say he's, you know, and it is a committee too. And, you know, if the economy really gets into trouble and there's massive job losses and stock markets are tanking, you know, that there's also, if he refuses to do it and it happens during Trump's term, I mean, Trump could be bringing up charges, investigating Warsh's mortgages. You know, he probably doesn't have any given his wife's fortune, but you know, he could be pushing for Warsh to be kicked out. That's why I don't know if that was the best choice either, but again, we will see.
Yeah, I know, that's great and greatly said. I mean, in the end, yeah, some people have been fearing that this Fed put, you might be gone once Warsh moves into office. But as you just said, you know, if there's one certainty, it's probably that if the market forces his hand at some point, he can say it all along. But you can always say it, but then the market might make him take these actions, yeah. Because yeah, it's just a sort of a structural thing, you know, and systemic in that sense. Just as you said in the beginning, you know, you're also in the short term kind of weary. You're like, okay, we could see this correction. And that's exactly where I'm like, okay, I hear these people talking like this, you know, speaking like this. They want to reprivatize everything. And maybe they want to try something which just doesn't work. And at some point they will see that they back themselves into a corner, and then they have to turn the wheel around, and fiscal flows and everything, it will just go fire up again. And then, yeah, assets like Bitcoin and other stuff will go haywire. Yeah.
I tend to think ultimately that's what's going to happen regardless of what anybody wants. And that the issue is that in order to get to that place, it might require a crisis. And so, you know, ideally that doesn't happen. I don't think that crisis would happen. That's not what I'm talking about with the 10% pullback. That would be more of a probably a 2027 type thing, where we're really seeing kind of a tanking economy, excuse me, and higher inflation, and like Warsh is trying to shrink the balance sheet at that point, and credit markets throw a tantrum, and all of a sudden he's like, okay, if I don't reverse on this, then the system's going to crash. And he has said, if you listen to him in podcasts, in those types of situations, the Fed needs to do what it needs to do. He's basically said the Fed was created to be a lender of last resort. And if the system's going to crash because there's not enough liquidity, he's going to be willing to expand the balance sheet. And he, you know, there was a saying in the US that only Nixon could go to China. He was considered kind of a China hawkish guy, but he was the one who was, maybe only Warsh can do, you know, massive QE.
That's a good point. Yeah, exactly. I never thought about it this way, but that could end up being the case. So yeah, Mel, thanks a lot for doing this. I guess we'll call it a day for today. And yeah, any last words? Where can people find you? Much appreciated that you came online.
Yeah, I mean, last words is just, this is a crazy, conflicted time, easy to be frustrated with things. It's a lot nicer like it was last summer, where the market just goes up, you know, 0.3% every day. My words are just, you know, those are times when, you know, you need to preserve capital, you need to keep your options open, you need to, you know, not beat yourself up too much. If there are some mistakes made, it's always a learning process, and you know, kind of fight through it. And if this is the type of market that you really like to trade, it's definitely given a lot of great range trading opportunities and potential, and a lot of incredible moves in places, like I said, like South Korea. So there's been opportunities in gold. So if people want to find me, Mel Madison 1 on Twitter, MelMattison. The number 1 on X, and MelMadison.com. And then I have my novel, Quaz, a financial thriller, available wherever books are sold, as well as an audio version, which is about kind of central bank intrigue and some things that are not too distant from the reality of what's going on.
Yeah,
quantum AI chilled. Computer. Yeah, quantum AI computers and different things like that. So
yeah, great. Thanks a lot, Mel. Enjoy the rest of your day, and see you next time.
Thank you.